You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks, she had a pet snake, she bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do, so she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
This episode is brought to you by our patrons, Ari Ashkenazi and Professor of Political Theory in Star Trek, Kathy Ferguson.
This is the Mythgreen Podcast. I'm Chris, and with me is...
Oren.
And we have a special reoccurring guest, Jim.
Hi, everybody. I'm back.
Sup, Jim. Yeah, you were back on the podcast once again.
Yeah, and Jim is here to tell us how terrible Greek mythology is and how it should never be used in speculative fiction ever.
That is definitely how Jim feels about Greek mythology.
That's the opposite of what I was promised. I don't know if I can deliver on that.
Well, how about you tell us instead how accurate all of the modern depictions of Greek mythology are in fiction? How well they get it right.
Oh, no. Oh, I can't do that because that's just not true. Wonder Woman, I'm looking at you here.
Okay, so I know you got beef with Wonder Woman. I'm going to ask you to put it aside for a bit because first I want to talk about why the Greek pantheon is important and like why Greek mythology matters to storytelling.
Do it. I want to hear.
All right, well, my personal opinion is that because Greek mythology has a huge influence on the Western storytelling tradition, you know, going all the way back to the spoken stories like the Iliad and such, and then extending into the Greek theater of the, you know, the famous tragedies. And so those lessons, even though those stories are not really very recognizable compared to what we use nowadays, like, you can still see some of the same DNA. And it's like, it's a long chain. And if you want to understand how we tell stories now, it can be very useful to study the Greek classics.
I completely agree, especially since for most of sort of Western educational history, it was everyone had to read the Greek classics like the Iliad, the Odyssey, and that was just a fundamental part of your higher education. So everyone writing the old stories we know were very well versed in those stories themselves from beforehand, which is something like nowadays most people haven't actually read any of that stuff, which is very disappointing if you want to nerd out at them for like an hour about why Hector isn't that cool.
Yeah, I understand that Hector's not that cool, Jim. You've mentioned this to me before.
So what do you think is if we were going to guess one of the most influential works, is it the Odyssey, the Iliad?
I would have to say the Odyssey is the most... I see the Odyssey more often in modern media and references to it. And it's just sort of like the quintessential journey to go somewhere and have little mini-adventures along the way. A lot of the longer Greek epics, especially the Odyssey and the Argonautica, or as most people call it, the Jason and the Argonauts, those are really just like the journey for the Golden Fleece and coming back, and... Ulysses going from that island he was trapped on trying to get home is really just an excuse to have all these like smaller stories embedded inside of them. And so Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is probably the most recent example that's really on the nose for just using a journey as an excuse to have side stories. And that's what you see in a lot of, what do you call it? There's a shorthand for stories that are essentially just the Odyssey again some more.
Travelogues?
Travelogues more
right.
Is a more general term.
Voyager was essentially the Odyssey.
Yeah, and you loved Voyager. I know you were a big fan.
I loved Voyager,
you know.
So much. I think the Iliad is referenced far less often. I think all you really get out of the Iliad from a modern references is just like people reference Achilles as being super good at stuff and also being a giant baby. And then Achilles heel is really what came out. Achilles heel and Trojan horse, I think, are the stamps the Iliad left on modern fiction and tropes and such, even though I like it more.
I have definitely read a lot of very impassioned internet arguments about whether or not we should interpret the Trojan horse as a deliberate trick or as a gift left by the departing Greeks that to the gods that the Trojans were like, we're going to steal that, and that's ours now.
Both, absolutely.
The internet is very divided on which one, though.
Is it
which
really?
One is more.
That's...
Well, I mean, I don't know the entire internet, just certain sections of Tumblr, right?
Pockets of the internet we hang out in are very divided on this issue.
That's right. Very strange, because it was left and said to be, like, so the Greeks left it, and they left someone, and now I forget his name, it wasn't Dolan. They left someone specifically to tell the Trojans that they had made it so big that they couldn't steal it. So the Trojans definitely stole it, but they were tricked into it by the Greeks. It's like, I don't understand why these are competing theories.
Well, I'll see if I can find them for you at some point. You can look at them. I think another reason that the Greek pantheon is popular today in specfic beyond just its influence on Western storytelling is that the Greek gods and Greek mythological characters in general have a couple of aspects that make them very appealing for modern storytellers. One of them is that many of these characters have well-identified abilities. Like, sometimes it's a straight-up, like, Zeus is known for throwing lightning, right? I mean, he does other stuff. He also shapeshifts.
Apollo throws lightning, too, sometimes, but, you know.
Right. Apollo is a little bit, actually, I would say, one of the lesser, like, he's one of the harder ones to pin down on what exactly he does. But, like, you know, Ares is known for being really good at fighting, regardless of if that's accurate to the mythology. Like, Athena is known for being very wise. Aphrodite is known for being super beautiful, all of that thing, right? And in fiction, those are handy shorthands, so that you can just say, this is the god of doing this thing, and you don't have to go into, like, the really complicated religion and, like, all of the different interpretations of that character.
Yeah, they're really good, for one-note, indications of what people, what you can expect out of a character, or even, like, a worshiper of them. You can just be like, this guy worships Ares, and you know immediately that they're about to throw down, or are willing to throw down, or probably decent at it. I think having sort of the swath of powers and being able to pick one out is definitely why they're so popular. And also, since they're people in America don't super worship them, you're not going to get into trouble for depicting a religion in a negative or positive light, because no one here really cares.
Yeah, it's not really a very active religion anymore. Not that it's not at all, just not on a large scale.
I will say there do seem to be a couple forms of Greek mythology and tales that were popular then and are still culturally iconic, but for some reason we don't really like to do that anymore. Like, the Greek tragedy is really well known. In addition, there were lots of mythology stories that were cautionary tales. And I feel like even though we still know about them, like, I think a really iconic one is Icarus, you know, who flies too close to the sun and then is... wings melt and falls down and dies. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're like, can you think of any stories that are actually following that model? Because I had trouble with that. It feels like we don't like to do the same level of tragedy or cautionary tales anymore.
But we don't like...
That's a bummer, man.
It's a bummer. We don't like stories where people lose that we like anymore. We don't have stories about tragedy. Yeah, Greek tragedy. Like, all of our popular movies have to end with the people we like doing a good job and winning, and the people we don't like losing. And, like, Icarus is sad because Daedalus's son died for being a doofus, and that's just not popular.
There are certainly still lots of cautionary tales. I don't know if any of them specifically follow the blueprint of Daedalus, but I mean, like half of Star Trek is probably cautionary tales. Which is weird because Star Trek is an optimistic future show, but like every other episode, they're running into some kind of technology that it's like, oh, that technology is scary, right? It's like, don't make robots, except Data. Data's cool, but don't make other kinds of robots. you know, like that. That's like a lot of Star Trek episodes do that sort of thing.
Yeah, right? I think it's notable that in Star Trek, generally the main cast is all fine, right? It's that they run into other people who have gotten themselves into trouble. So, like, the side characters, the one-off characters of the episode become the cautionary tale characters. And where, as opposed to the traditional cautionary tale, well, you have the protagonist that is flawed, and the flaw brings their downfall.
Wasn't there a Star Trek episode where someone literally flew into the sun?
Yeah, but it worked just fine.
Okay.
That was not a cautionary tale. That was a Dr. Crusher solves a murder mystery episode. which they came back to later when Crusher needed to hide from a Borg ship, and she was like, oh right, we can fly into suns. This is handy. But anyway.
Yeah.
I
have to say, I am surprised that more of those figures like Icarus haven't been taken and, like, sort of bastardized. Like, for instance, the original Sleepy Hollow tale is totally different than what we're doing with Sleepy Hollow now. Completely different. But Sleepy Hollow was still iconic, so people sort of took that and then made their own thing with it. And I'm surprised that with some of these figures like Icarus, like, there hasn't been more of that.
Oh, there's Kid Icarus.
Hmm?
There's the video game Kid Icarus, where you play as Icarus.
That's true. There's that.
Or
as I like to call it, that weird winged guy from Super Smash Brothers that I don't know.
I like him. I like playing him. He's cool.
But it's notable to me that, like, Icarus is a very popular name for experimental spaceships in fiction. And, like, sometimes bad things happen to them and sometimes it doesn't. For some reason, that's the thing that specfic authors really like. Is like, this ship is new and different. I'm going to name it Icarus. And it's like, okay.
Well, that's another, that's sort of like the Achilles heel in the Trojan horse. It's a good mnemonic, I'm probably using that word wrong. It's a word you can slap onto something to show that you know it's possibly a bad idea or very risky. And it
would raise tension. There's a good question about whether somebody would actually name their ship that. Right.
I mean, you might. I think it really depends on the person. I would get behind naming something the Icarus just as sort of a recognition that you're reaching possibly further than you should, but you want to do it anyways. Like, Icarus is Icarus is iconic, I think, of the human want to do something rad. And get, like, why do people climb Everest? There's nothing up there except the top of Everest, and people, like, the entire thing is littered with corpses. Like, that's very Icarian. So I absolutely think naming stuff Icarus is self-aware, at the very least.
Yeah, I could see someone doing it. I don't know of anyone who actually has. Like, as far as I know, there haven't been any NASA programs called Icarus. But once they start, we'll know we're in science fiction land. Another sort of artifact of Greek mythology that has survived very strongly, or at least in name, are the various, like, monsters. Like, video games and roleplay games, and even, like, books really like, you know, harpies, sirens, cyclopses, medusas. Those are, like, Greek mythology is very rich for mining monsters out of.
Yeah, you got Dragon's Teeth comes from the Argonautica. You see that just referenced, like, that was in a Star Trek episode. That was in Voyager. Voyager really liked its Greek mythos, apparently. The Gorgon, a giant metal bull. What else? Talos, the giant bronze man of bronze, like 30 foot tall, just bronze dude hanging out.
As familiar with that one. Where does that one show up?
In modern time or in Greek mythos?
Yeah, in modern time. Oh. I know who he is from mythology because you tell me about him on Facebook all the time.
Oh,
you know.
In modern mythos, I don't think, like, Talos... Like, you see the name Talos show up. I can't think of a specific example, but I'm just thinking of, like, giant mobile statues made of a metal that you're usually throwing something at you or being generally rude like that. That's very old. That's the earliest I can think of.
All right, are we ready to talk about Wonder Woman?
Yeah, we should probably talk about Wonder Woman.
Okay, can I just start with, since I know that Jim probably has a lot more to say than me, I just want to start with, why is she named Diana? That really, really bugged me. Diana, so Diana is the name of a Roman goddess. And it's like using Zeus and Ares. They're clearly trying to go with a Greek mythology theme. But then they name her after, and she is supposed to be at least a demigod, right? And then they throw a Roman name in there, and it really bugs me. It's crossing the streams. She should actually be Artemis would be the most equivalent Greek god. Although she could be Athena too.
Well,
I was just agreeing that she could probably be Athena.
Okay, I think if you... All right, so I think if you want an in-universe explanation, I guess the idea is that she's, like, is that those gods all exist in the universe, so, like, calling her Athena would be weird because Athena also exists.
Well, she's dead now.
Whereas... Well, she's dead now, but she... Like, they maybe named her after Athena or something, but, like, in different versions of the Wonder Woman canon, those gods are alive. And so it would be kind of awkward for her to also be named Athena and go talk to Athena. So they use Diana because it's like, you're like linked to that. And I think out of canon, out of universe, I'm pretty sure that her name was Diana long before they decided she was an Amazon. I could be wrong about that, but I think the original Wonder Woman was not an Amazon. I think she was just a lady. So, Wonder Woman fans, fact check me on that. I think her name was...
So they named her Diana, and then they decided that she was, like, associated with Zeus and Ares and all that?
Yeah, I think so. I could be wrong. Jim, you know more about the DC continuity than I do.
I know marginally more about comic books in general. I don't know Wonder Woman's original background story from when she was first created. That is outside of my ken, unfortunately.
It could be complete coincidence, but it is an awful coincidence that she was named after a Roman goddess.
Well, I mean, they cross their streams on a lot of stuff. That's one of my major beefs, is when she confronts the rude German general, and he hears her speaking Greek, he's like, oh, the Greeks loved Ares. They loved war, and they worshipped him as the coolest dude, and he's definitely thinking of the Romans. The Romans loved Mars. The Greeks thought Ares was kind of a doofus. Again, he was not well regarded. War, they knew war was bad. They knew war messed everything up and caused strife. That's why most of the Iliad, when people die, they talk about how their fathers and wives and sons and daughters will never see them again, and how they had like this cool house and now they're dead and won't go home. There's like paragraphs dedicated to that. The Greeks were not into the idea of lives being wasted for no reason.
They were just into tragedy, right? So for them, this is a big tragedy if you have a war.
It's generally sad. The end of the Odyssey, the Ulysses' hometown, he went to the Trojan War. He brought all the youthful warrior men with him. They all died. He was the only one that came home. And then when he got home, he killed all the new young men who were courting his wife. He slaughtered two generations of dudes. And the town called him out on it at the end. They're like, you killed all the men. All of them. And then Athena showed up and was like, he did, but chill. It is sad, but also chill. So there's this recognition.
So are you saying that Athena is the originator of not all men? Because, like, you know, she was like, maybe not all the men are dead.
quite possibly. but yeah, that really bugged me in Wonder Woman when he gave the speech about how the Greeks thought Ares was super, super cool. And I was like, the Romans thought they were cool because they had the more organized, larger military force that they used to expand and create order and roads and stuff. And the Greeks were like, the Greeks had Ares punked on a regular basis by Athena, and also Zeus would call him a big whiny baby all the time. Happens in the Iliad.
Now, how much of this is the Greeks and how much of it is the Athenians? Because, like, the Athenians, with, you know, Athena being their patron goddess, maybe had a bit of a motivation to try to make her seem like the coolest and Ares not as cool. I'm not an expert on this, but I feel like maybe the Spartans would have had a different thing to say about this.
You would need like an actual scholar of Greek mythology to get into that. It might very well be just regional to the Athenians, but a lot of the mythos we have that I have read does not portray Ares as a super laudable fellow. He's bloodthirsty and starts fights and kills people and generally doesn't have a good reason for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't be surprised if Athens just had more cultural influence and a lot of the stories came out of Athens, right? Which might be true, but at the same time, later, it's kind of hard to sort that out. And if there were a strong cultural influence, their stories could have reached Sparta too, right?
Especially since a lot of... whoever wrote down a lot of these stories are not the same people that made them up, and the stories like get warped and twisted, and there's different, like, there's different versions of every story as well. Like, the Argonautica was written down hundreds of years, which is a prequel to the Iliad and the Odyssey, was written down hundreds of years after that was written down, and both were, like, in spoken word before that. So it's all a giant mess.
Yeah. So, you can tell me what you know of this, Jim, but we might want to mention, talk about the Amazons a little bit.
I love the Amazons.
Another interesting one that, you know, we romanticize a lot today, but it's originally, from what I know, the Amazons were not, like, glorified in Greek tales. They were, like, bad women doing bad things, and we kind of have to tame them and make them good.
So, what I know about the Amazons, and I haven't delved deep into their origins, is I've not read any stories of them being bad women that have to be made good. My favorite Amazon run-in is Hercules, while he's doing his labors. He has to go get the girdle from Hippolyta, and essentially his uncle is trying to kill Hercules by making him do all this dumb stuff. So he assumes the Amazons will kill him when he tries to get this girdle. But he goes up, and Hippolyta just thinks he's cool, and he's like, "Hey, can I have that?" And she's like, "Yeah, you can have that." And he just leaves. It's like the shortest labor, and it's very chill. There's no rude thing said about the Amazons. The Amazons show up in the Argonautica when Jason stops by and actually falls in love with an Amazonian queen, and that's like one of the first romantic stories of like love between equals. Jason and this Amazon are like, it's like weird that she's his equal, but he's very into it. And they leave them in good relations. And then there's another Amazon, Penthesilea, who was Hippolyta's sister and gets Hippolyta killed, and she goes to redeem her honor by fighting for Troy during the Trojan War. And she's pretty cool. I think the actual, the longer version is Lost, but the shorthand is she fights Achilles and Achilles kills her, but he falls in love with her afterwards because she was like a great warrior and a beautiful woman. And he's like, man, just the coolest. So like, I actually haven't run into a negative portrayal of Amazons in my perusal through the narrow window.
Well, that's seen. Definitely good to hear, because sometimes when we, like, look back at older stories and take, you know, positive, you know, female figures, it turns out that they were not actually seen in a positive light later, which is an unfortunate truth of in Lord of the Rings, where Eowyn is not actually, like, she is a battle maiden, but she's a battle maiden because she's, like, depressed, basically, because she's unhappy, not because that's, like, a cool thing that she does.
What she's into?
Yeah, it's because her heart has grown like sad and brittle, because and she's lost hope, and then she meets a guy, and then she's happy again, and then she never goes back on the battlefield ever again.
I definitely know that when I lose hope, the first thing I decide to do is go fight orcs.
Yeah,
that's like number one on my list. Is like, I'm sad and I don't feel like there's any point. I'm gonna go fight an orc.
Yeah,
it's like that takes a lot of motivation to get up in the morning and go fight orcs. I'll tell you one writer who was kind of into the idea of Amazons being like bad women who needed to be tamed, and his name was William Shakespeare. And I think he was a pretty old guy, so he was probably a contemporary of like the ancient Greeks,
if
I recall correctly. Yeah, but in Midsummer Night's Dream, this is easy to miss because this is not what the play's about.
Mm-hmm.
But in Midsummer Night's Dream, the Duke of Athens, first of all, the Duke of Athens, mm-hmm. what? Anyway, the Duke of Athens Duke. Has just defeated the Amazons in a war and has like claimed their queen as his bride, and this is like a good thing. And it's really easy to miss because most of the play is about fairies like turning people into donkeys and what have you. But like, that's in there; it's in the background.
Okay.
I mean, that might be an actual Greek myth or historical record. I have no idea.
Well, I'm pretty sure that the Duke of Sparta didn't defeat the Amazonians in battle. That I like, historically speaking, I find that suspect.
Mm-hmm. well, they could be among... I mean, there are some characters that, over time, even in similar cultures, their role shifts, like Morgan Le Fay being a classic where she started out as a good guy. So it's possible that the Amazons are portrayed negatively in some stories and positively in others, and or that their outlook on them changed as the stories went on.
I've noticed, I think, just based on what I have seen nowadays, it is more common for the Greek gods, if they are actually present in the story, it is more likely that they will be villains. And this could just be a result of them being gods, and like the story about a literal god isn't maybe that interesting. But all of the examples I can think of where the gods actually show up, they are usually villains. Like, you know, we got Xena, we got Wonder Woman, although, I mean, Wonder Woman had Zeus, but he was dead. You know, we have the Star Trek episode with Apollo, definitely a bad guy. I think the Greek gods just make good villains as well, because they're so, like, you know, they have such, like, understandable motives, mm-hmm. but are so powerful.
Which is, and you can, because they're not largely active religion, you can tone down their power set and make them defeatable as well. Which I think is kind of, I got beef with that, where it's like, well, you can't defeat, you know, the monotheistic god, because he's too powerful. But Greek gods, even though they're gods, like, I guess you could probably take them if you try real hard.
Yeah, well, the gods are certainly, I think, depicted as fallible in the mythology, and, you know, it's possible to kill them, etc. So even if they're supposed to be powerful, it seems possible that they're either less powerful, you know, later when your story takes place, or that they have some sort of key weakness that you can take advantage of or something like that.
Well, usually you can get them in the old stories if you're also a god. They're generally mm-hmm. not subject to human offenses, except if they're filled with NBA Jam fire, like Diomede. Like, if you're being imbued, by NBA Jam fire, I mean Diomede literally gets, like, coated in fire, essentially, by Athena, and she tells him, you should probably stab Aphrodite, and also Mars if you see him. And then he does, and they are big whiny babies about it. Did he
point out that Mars is a Roman god and that Athena is a little confused?
Possibly. She meant Ares. The version that I listen to very often actually switches between a lot of Romanization and Greek names for the characters, so I switch back and forth myself as well.
Yeah, so the strange thing is, as far as I know, the Roman and the Greek gods, they are such a similar pantheon, but supposedly some of them actually have separate origins. It's like convergent evolution or something. I'm not exactly sure on that, but it is very strange how similar they are when supposedly they don't actually have the same origin, or at least not all of them.
Right. Well, my understanding on that is that that whole Mediterranean area did a lot of mix and matching with its gods, and then when Rome became powerful, they wanted to be like the Greeks, because the Greeks were, like, known to be the bastions of culture in that part of the world, and the Romans were like, we want to be like that, and for people to see us like that. And so I think that there was at least some active decisions made to make Roman gods more like their Greek counterparts. Not like, I can't guarantee that, get us a full, you know, PhD scholar on here, maybe they can tell us. But that's my understanding of why that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, like, I could be wrong, but what's the Roman equivalent of Athena? Is it Diana or Juno?
I'm actually not sure, because Diana is equivalent to Artemis, and so I don't know who would be Roman Athena.
Because, like, I feel like the Romans didn't really care that much about their Minerva. Athena parallel. Minerva, yeah. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Right, probably because they were too busy worshipping Mars. I mean, Athena is... War is one of her domains, right? Like,
have more than one god of war? Man, that's getting crowded.
Yeah, Athena could do everything, apparently. She was, like, crafts was and really wisdom and war. Like, she had way too many specialties. She was so OP.
Yeah. okay, so we're almost out of time. So I just want to... We can go around and say what our favorite use of Greek mythology is before we finish this episode. And I think my favorite is going to have to be Apollo from Who Mourns for Adonai in Star Trek. And that's a flawed episode, to be certain. But I just love how humanistic it is, and how it's like, you know, no kings, no gods, only humans, except for that last line that they stuck in there to make it sound like Kirk was Christian. But other than that, I think it's a great episode. Chris, you got a favorite?
I did not come prepared for this homework assignment. like, this is like a pop quiz. Was not warned. Was not told. I mean, admittedly, when I think of stuff, I mostly have complaints. I'm sure there's something I really like somewhere, unidentified.
All right, well, Jim, now Chris has marked abstain on her question.
Okay, well, my favorite probable use that I can think of off the top of my head is I actually really like the movie Troy. It is wrong on so many levels and in so many ways, but their portrayal of Achilles, and especially the opening scene where there's just this hulking dude and he essentially one-shots him in this very acrobatic single strike through the collarbone with his sword, is just like, that is the best embodiment visually of what Achilles must have been like in that mythos. Just this unstoppable, almost nonchalant, until he's raging out, murder machine. It's impressive and feels good to see that come to life in a visual medium.
Naturally, I have complaints about Troy.
Trust me, I do too.
The thing that bugs me the most about Troy, and this is weird because LOTR, the movies, had just come out, so you'd think that, like, magical stuff, you know, was just getting popular. Maybe it was only a little bit after and they hadn't planned for it. But, like, they try to make it completely, they basically take out all the fantastical parts and try to make it actually ambiguous whether there's any, like, gods or magic of any kind happening.
Thetis shows up.
I'm pretty sure every single time a god shows up in the movie that they could easily be human.
Oh, like, just Thetis shows up, and she shows up all magical-like, and is like, hey, how's it going?
Okay, because, like, when Achilles dies, he gets, like, shot in a bunch of places, and then they show him get shot in the heel, and then it's like, yeah. Is it the heel that did it? Maybe?
Or was it the 10 other arrows?
yeah. What destiny and what's meant to happen and what the gods are and are not in control of in the actual Iliad is, like, kind of open to interpretation. It's like, are the gods making Achilles strong enough to kill all these people, or do they just know that he's going to and then die to the ankle, and so they know, like, he is fated to take Troy because he's just that good at fighting? It's like, hard to really know, and they don't go into it. And a lot of your reporting on how good people are at doing things or getting stuff done, they attribute their success to godly influence, but that's also a way of doing honor to the gods, sort of like how in modern times, if you do something like really cool, you might say, well, I only through like God's grace did I do this.
My sponsor.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks.
Pretty sure that's
too.
The modern version. I want to thank my sponsors.
But I just want to point out that though you didn't say that he was immune, I think this is a popular misconception that a lot of people have, that Achilles just couldn't take damage. He actually does get hit in the arm by Aeneas with an arrow in the Iliad. So it's not like all of his body was impervious to damage except for his ankle. It's just that he couldn't be killed unless he was hit there. Due to the dipping in the sticks or the burning in the fire, depending on which version you read.
All right. Well, speaking of Achilles' heels, we have met the Achilles' heel of this podcast, which is that we are over time. So thank you for joining us, Jim. And those of you at home, if anything we said piqued your interest, if we made, like, Greek mythology wrong, you can email us at podcast@mythcreants.com and let us know. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. When he came around, tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess who saved herself. This has been the Mythcreant Podcast.
opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Coulton.